There is more truth in this than in most of Hitler's sayings. The Reichswehr has indeed become the great collection point for almost all of non-Nazi Germany. Here, average Germans can follow their instinct for proficiency, their need for action, and also their intellectual and moral cowardice. Here is an arena where you do not continually need to raise your arm, where you can even let yourself go a little and permit yourself a coarse word or two about Hitler or the Nazis in general without too much danger. An area where you are effectively and thoroughly kept occupied, where everything runs like clockwork and you do a good job. Best of all, you need only do your duty in silence, and so you are relieved of the need to think or take moral responsibility for your actions. You do not have to ask yourself for whom and for what you will one day have to use your weapon. For many years, those who needed an additional sedative also persuaded themselves that one day the Reichswehr will make an end of the whole sham. They carefully failed to see that it was just the Reichswehr that formed the channel through which their capabilities were pressed into Hitler's service. This is an important, decisive process. In Jüterbog, I experienced a tiny sliver of it, but I saw it in magnified close-up with all its psychological details. We were eager recruits. After a couple of weeks, we had almost entirely forgotten how strange it was that we should be learning to shoot in order to pass our legal examinations. Military life has its own rules. Once you are immersed in it, you are no longer free to ask why you got there in the first place. We were fully occupied in cleaning our rifles and our boots, aiming and taking cover properly, marching in proper formation and in step. Besides, we were far too exhausted to think. The petty officers were extremely kind, the opposite of the harsh sergeant majors of tradition. We were heartily glad to have escaped Nazi lectures, and felt we had gotten off very lightly. Indeed, when one afternoon, it was even a Saturday afternoon, a co-referendar, who occupied some middling position in the party, tried to organize such a lecture, there was a riot. The lecture was continually interrupted by foot scraping and restless shuffling, and that night the referendar was almost beaten up. Quite open criticisms in unparliamentary language were voiced, not quite of the content of the lecture itself, but certainly of its quality, which was called an insult to our intelligence. Being soldiers, we could say such things. In the first few days, when we had only been referendars, we would not have dared to. Thus, we believed we had escaped ideological training, even while we were thoroughly immersed in it. Then one day we had a lecture that capped it all. This time it was not party propaganda. Nothing about the Jews, or the system, or the Führer's magical powers, or the shameful peace treaty of Versailles. None of all that. No, it was something much more effective. Our lieutenant and commander-in-chief gave us a talk about the Battle of the Marne. Had he been a professional propagandist, he could not have made a more subtle or cunning choice. Probably he acted entirely instinctively in choosing his topic and honestly believed the opinions he wanted to impart. The Germans have a very different picture of the Battle of the Marne from the rest of the world. Elsewhere, people argue whether the victory was primarily due to Gallieni or Joffre or Foch. But that question is completely meaningless in Germany, because there it is not even admitted that it was an Allied victory. Rather, the picture that is firmly fixed in the German mind is one of a battle where a German victory was prevented only by abandoning the field because of unfortunate misunderstandings, just as the decision was going their way. What is more, without these misunderstandings, not only the battle, but the whole war would have been irrevocably won. It was because of these misunderstandings that the war now became one of attrition in the trenches. The Germans would have won that, too, if it had not been for... At this point, further legends set in. This picture, which they have drawn for themselves, tortures the Germans. It is like a thorn in their flesh. They are not nearly as interested in the question of war guilt, which is so important for other nations. Secretly, they would not mind being guilty of starting the war, though they will not, of course, publicly admit that. What vexes and torments them is that they lost the war. They try to explain away the final collapse, either by the legend of the stab in the back, or by claiming that Germany voluntarily laid down its arms, trusting in Wilson's 14 points, only to find itself shamefully betrayed. Yet that does not pain them as much as the loss of the Battle of the Marne. for at that moment, so the German legend goes, the Germans let slip the glorious final victory that was already within their grasp, all because of stupid misunderstandings, confusion, and ridiculous little errors of organization. That they cannot bear. Almost every German has the battle sketch of the positions of the armies on the 5th and 6th of September 1914 before his inner eye, and almost every one of them has desperately moved the black marks this way or that. If only the Second Army had turned just a little, or if only the reserves had been brought up this tiny bit, the war would have been won. Why did the generals fail to make these moves? Even today they discuss whose fault it was that the disastrous, unnecessary order to retreat was issued. General Moltke's, Colonel Hench's, or General Bülow's? An inevitable consequence of this picture is the idea that must be corrected. We must start the contest over, just as it was then, and this time we will make no mistakes. Not even the shameful Treaty of Versailles calls as strongly for a rematch and revenge as this technical incompetence, this accidentally lost battle that was really a victory. Our lieutenant let the whole affair roll past our eyes, just as the German legend describes it. He let the First Army make its famous manoeuvre, wheeling away from Paris. He described Gallieni's flank attack from that city and how the First Army turned to the northwest in forced marches and brought Gallieni to a standstill, but how in doing that it opened the infamous gap between itself and the Second Army. At this point, the Second Army's reserves should have... Instead, there was the infirm commander-in-chief, far from the front and ill-informed. Colonel Hench had a crisis of nerves, and so on, right up to the unbearable, incorrect, and unacceptable end. In this mood, tormented and dissatisfied, he left us. Immediately military discussions broke out. If Bülow, if Hench, if Kluck. At this point the Second and Third Armies should have started a pincer movement against Foch. We were all eagerly correcting the Battle of the Marne 19 years after the event. Almost unnoticeably the discussion moved to the prospects for a new war and how it would be done better next time. Just wait till our rearmament is complete. But they won't let us complete it, someone said. Oh, yes, they will, said another. They know only too well that we may not have enough soldiers yet, but we do have enough airplanes, so that before we are done for we can mount a night attack on Paris and flatten it. And we thought that we had not been undergoing ideological training, that we had not become Nazis.